We want to begin with Romans chapter 11, verses 1 through 6. Paul is still talking about God's people and whether or not they were cut off, whether or not that was just, and how the Gentiles are tied into God's plan. Starting in Romans 11, 1, he says, I say then, did God cast off his people? That, of course, would be the Jews. God forbid. For I also am an Israelite, of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God did not cast off his people, which he foreknew. Or know ye not that Scripture saith of Elijah, how he pleadeth with God against Israel? Verse 3, Lord, they have killed thy prophets, they have digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have left for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. But if it is by grace, it is no more of works. Otherwise, grace is no more grace. When you start looking at chapters 9 and 10, you have some arguments there that relate to this question that Paul asks at the beginning of Romans chapter 11. He says, did God cast off, did God throw away his people? Was God uninterested in his people? Well, you, even if you didn't have Paul's answer, could probably answer that question, and what would the answer be? God, you know, loves all people. John 3:16, he did not want to cast off his people. So Paul has shown that time and time again. As you go back to Romans chapter 10, if you just want to skip across the page there and look at verses 16 and 21 with me, you can see two related verses. He says in 10:16, but there's a contrast. They, that would be the Jews, they did not all hearken. They did all listen to the glad tidings. They didn't want to hear the message. Isaiah was so bad that he said, Lord, who has believed our report? So it wasn't that God said, I don't like you. You're of no interest to me. God said, yes, you're going to be cut off, but the reason is going to be what? If you have no interest in me, if you don't want to follow me, then what? We recognize the same principle today, right? What happens if you invite somebody over to Thanksgiving meal, or maybe it's Christmas time, we're headed to that time of year, and the person says, I don't want your yucky food. I'd get sick if I ate at your table. I'd vomit. Well, if they begin to say those kinds of things, you as a potential host would say what? Yeah, I mean, if that's how you really feel, okay. I have a nice invitation. I'm going to have a nice meal, but if you are uninterested, that's your business. And you can, you know, go down to Wendy's and get your chili if you want, whatever that might be. All right. Huh? Yeah, that's right. If they're open, good luck with that. Maybe a microwave dish that day. And then as you look at the end of Romans 10, verse 21, but as to Isaiah, or Israel, he saith, all the day long, did I spread out my hands unto what kind of people? A disobedient and a contrary. There were some other translations there, one of which would be a gainsaying people. It's like that meal again. God says, I've prepared it. I have begged. I have pleaded. I have opened my arms wide. You have rejected and rejected and rejected. And finally, after enough rejections, God says, I've had enough, and you have essentially disqualified yourself. We've seen this expression, God forbid. You also see that in Romans chapter 11 and verse 1, and that is a way of saying absolutely not. That, I think, starts in 3:4, and you find several other examples of it in this book. In the latter part of verse 1, Paul uses himself to prove what point. He says, has God cast off Israel? And then Paul says, who's exhibit A? Who can we point to show that's not true? All right, Paul says, look at me. I'm proof. I'm evidence that God has not cast off his people. He says, number one, who am I? I am an Israelite. Well, did God cast off Israel? If Paul is in a right relationship with God, he's certainly not cast off his people. He doesn't stop there. He says, I'm also, if you want to think about the tribe, he said, I'm a member of what tribe? I'm a member of the Benjamites. I'm from the tribe of Benjamin. And then he says, if there are any questions, I'm going to take my family history and trace it all the way back to who? Let's talk about Abraham. I'm also connected to him. So Paul says, I am saved. I'm in a right relationship with God. My spiritual condition is fine. That would not be true if God had cut off the Jewish people. Here is one of the places where we want to stop and ask the question, was Paul in a right relationship with God because of his bloodline or something else? It was something else. It wasn't blood. It wasn't that ancestral or family tie. He was in a right relationship with God for what reason?
He obeyed.
He was pursuing that righteousness which comes through faith, and that faith, of course, is obedient. We already saw back in Romans chapter 2, verses 28 and 29, Paul said, you are not a Jew if you are one inwardly or outwardly. You're not a Jew if you are one outwardly. You can undergo, as a male, you can undergo the process of circumcision that used to be the sign of the covenant, but that is no longer the case. You might have the exterior trappings. That physically, you might look like you are a child of God. But he says the true Jew is one who is a Jew inwardly. It's a matter now of the heart. It's a matter now of being. It's a matter now of being someone who is willing to obey God. Moving down a little bit more, Galatians chapter 6 and verse 16 would be a good cross reference there. Romans, Galatians, there are a lot of parallels in those books, even though size wise they are very, very different. Anything you want to add or ask over verse 1 before we move down to verse 2? In that second verse, you sort of have some repetition. Paul comes at the point from a slightly different perspective. He talks about the people that God foreknew. Who do you think that would be, the Jews or the Gentiles? All right, he's talking about the Jews still. And he says, God foreknew these people. Did he foreknow them to reject them? No. Foreknowledge wasn't for that. And we know that because of passages like 1 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 22. The people that God foreknew were the people who would walk by faith. Old preachers, and I think they probably didn't go quite far enough with this, but because they were battling some denominational errors, this was, I think of it sometimes when you look at politicians, they're really complicated problems, but if you have a politician that wants to win, how does he summarize the problem? Does he get into all the little details and all the nuts and bolts? How do you win your position politically? Okay, I'll start with you and then we'll go to Dolores.
I'm sorry.
What was your answer?
Oh, bring out special things.
All right, you're going to highlight some things. You don't get into A to Z, but let's just pick up a couple of things. Dolores?
Hot topics.
Yes, the hot topics. And sometimes those single sentence political statements. I'm for, and then you can just sort of sum up the position, even though that summary statement really doesn't deal with the issue because there are so many parts to that. And when you start looking at this, you see a similar thing here. When we talk about walking by faith, that is there, and it's a statement that sums up a lot of different things. And that has always been what God has required. Romans chapter 1 and verse 17, we saw it there. It is faith unto faith. So there's a little there, but it says a lot. And politicians sometimes do the same thing, but for a much different reason. At the end of verse 2, who's Paul introduced? He talks about the Old Testament character that was the prophet Elijah. Let's go back to the Old Testament for just a second and take a look at 1 Kings chapter 19, verses 10 through 14. Paul does a good job of highlighting what took place, but this additional cross-reference I think will help us get a better or fuller understanding of why he's going back there. 1 Kings chapter 19, verses 10 through 14. Who'd like to read that in just a minute? Gary? All right, from that 19th chapter of 1 Kings, let's start with verse 10 and go down through verse 14.
And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away. And he said, go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains, and break in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still small voice. And it was so, when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entering in of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him and said, what doest thou here, Elijah? And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away.
Thank you very much. People talk about the peaks and the valleys of life. If you think about that illustration or analogy in terms of Elijah and this time in his life, would you say that he was at a peak, a high point, or a valley, a low point?
Low point.
He's pretty low. And that's why God does what he does. This is a period of time where Jezebel was creating some problems for him. He thought that that wicked woman was really after him and going to do him in and so forth. And Elijah's looking around and things look really, really bad. He looks around and sometimes I think people can look at their country and think, it's changed a lot. Maybe it's changed a lot for the better, or it's changed a lot for the worse. The institutions that we have, the beliefs that we have, good things are being torn down, good things are being ripped apart. And that's kind of what Elijah was looking at. He specifically mentions the altars. Here are the altars for God. Here are the places of worship. And what's happening, if we put that in modern terms, here are the church buildings. What's happening to the church buildings? All right, they're burning them down. You know, they're being sold to developers for places to, open up some farms and get better housing for people. They don't want the church buildings anymore. You think that would get the attention of Christians? God, look at how many church buildings they bulldozed. Hard to find a church building to go and assemble with God's people. So you've got that. You've got the threats of Jezebel. And then you've got Israel's sins. So notice carefully what the text says. It's easy to miss. God did not cast off his people which he foreknew, or don't you know about the scripture? And we looked at part of that. How he pleads with God. Well, we know what it means to plead with someone, don't we? What comes to mind there? You're pleading with someone. Is that sort of a, would you mind doing this? Or is that an urgent beseeching? It's an urgent beseeching. In fact, that word which is translated pleading is rendered intercession in the King James translation. You also see that word used earlier in the book, Romans chapter 8 and verse 27, and Romans chapter 8 and verse 34. So it is this begging, it is this urgent pleading. If you didn't have any more information, and you know that there is God's prophet, and you know that Jezebel is creating some problems for him, you're probably thinking that the urgent pleading would be against who? Who would that be directed towards or against? All right, that would be my first guess. Jezebel, here is this wicked woman. And I'm sure that some prayers were directed to God involving Jezebel. But what does the text say here in Romans chapter 11? He pleads with God against who? Israel. Now, can you imagine that? Can you imagine a preacher today getting up and praying, oh God, this is a terrible congregation. This is we have a bunch of snakes here. And God crush them. God destroy them. God take away their jobs. God brings sorrow upon them. God afflict their children. I don't know exactly what that was as far as a prayer, but this is what he's doing against God's people. That should have shaken him up, shouldn't it? I think today if a preacher got up and prayed those kinds of things, I mean, people, if they weren't paying attention before, it wouldn't be very long before they were going to say, hey, you know, what is going on? Stop that guy, you know, run him out in his ear. We don't want that kind of thing. Well, that's what Elijah was doing. Why did Elijah do that? You think he was just having a bad day, or you think something else was going on? Who do you think were tearing down those altars? Who was burning down the church buildings? It would have been Israel. Now today, if we think about somebody destroyed the church building, there's been a rash of fires, arson, we would assume that who's doing that? We've had some, maybe not graffiti here, but we've had some damage to our sign. And I think the assumption is, and we could be wrong, but the assumption is generally who's doing that? All right, we have some people who are not favorably disposed towards God or the church. But what would happen if we were to find out that a Christian were doing that? That gives us a much different perspective. This is what Israel was doing. They were trying to destroy what was right, and who are they turning to? You've got this time and time again in the Old Testament. Look at verse 3. Lord, they, and those weren't the Gentiles, those were the Jews. They've done what? They have killed the prophets. And when it comes to the altars, what have they done? Dug down. Let's pause there for just a second and think about that detail. It would be one thing to destroy a structure. But what happens when you go and you dig down? Why do that? Especially in ancient times. You got this altar. And it's not obviously as secure as something like a church building that you've got a foundation that, you know, maybe you got 8-foot walls, 10-foot walls, something like that. But why dig down? You got the pile of rocks there. Why dig down? All right, destruction would certainly be foremost in the mind. Anything else?
Bury it so someone else could use it.
Well, that could be. Yeah, I think all those points are good. What happens when somebody wants to show absolute contempt for something? I mean, it's like the guy, he is frustrated with his TV, and he really wants to show his frustration. You think that one hammer blow will be enough to probably destroy the TV?
No.
You don't? You don't think you can take a hammer blow and smash the screen and that does it in?
It'd probably be enough to destroy it, but he keeps beating at it.
But why? I mean, if one, assuming you got a bigger, got small sledgehammer, and I mean just one whack, we'll go ahead and do the screen in. So it's already cracked, it's already destroyed, you've maybe opened up the cheap plastic. So why continue to beat your TV?
Because it's
All right. I think that's one good answer. Anything else?
I'm going to destroy every last bit of it.
Yeah. You are really looking at contempt. There is absolute disgust for this. You are saying, I want to renounce any appreciation that I have for my TV, so I'll just continue to whack it and crack it until it is in pieces. So if these people, and we believe that the writer is accurate as far as what Paul is saying, that they did dig up the altars, it was to show absolute disgust. Now, if you see that, you see your people, your brethren, and that's Elijah, doing this kind of stuff, if you're truly trying to serve God, how are you going to feel? Frustrated? Think you're going to feel angry?
Disappointed.
Yes, disappointed. But what else might you feel? Looks like everybody's burning down the church buildings. It's in the text. What's the answer?
I'm afraid.
Well, there's that, but what else?
I'm the only one. Well.
Yeah. You think we would feel like that today? God, who's left? All the elders are gone. All the church building are gone. Everybody wants to go out there and worship Baal. There is nobody left but me. Well, notice what else is said. I am left alone, and what do they do?
They're trying to kill me.
So he says, plead. I'm making that great intercession. That's from the perspective of Elijah. But then Paul says we've got a second perspective, and the second perspective is God. As God is viewing this, here's Elijah. You can imagine, just like we would today, when you see something torn down that we believe is right, consistent with the will of God, what's the question that's going through our mind as a child of God? God, all this bad stuff is taking place. You look at it, you see it, you don't like it, you conclude it's wrong, contrary to God's will. So where does the mind go? God, yeah, where are you? Why don't you do something? Why are you staying inactive? I mean, look at what your people are doing. They're digging up the altars. There's nobody left to worship with. Tempting to believe that God is not noticing what's taking place. Tempting to think that God is not interested. But notice what you find in verse 4. You don't have to go down very far. But what saith the answer of God unto him? Do you remember that passage that we read? Did God show up and say, I've heard you, and I'm going to give you an answer, and you're going to see my power? Well, we just had Gary read that, and we went through all that. And what's part of God's answer? Look at verse 4. I, God says, have what? I have
7,000 men.
All right. I've still got 7,000 people. Now, do you think that number was actually 7,000, not 6,999 or 7,001? Do you think it was an even 7,000?
No.
It could have been. But when you look at the number 7 in the Bible, that is a number of completeness, a number of fullness. And in this case, obviously, you have a lot of people who are missing in action, so to speak, because of their actions. And then you multiply that by 1,000. God was simply saying, I have still a significant number of people who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Based on what you can see, it looks like things are really in disaster mode. For us, there's a practical lesson there. Think about where we are as far as our country. It seems each year to become more difficult to reach people who are interested in spiritual things. But if you start looking around the world at other places, what do you find as far as church growth? Do you know? There are a lot of places in the world where Christianity is growing. And there are different reasons for that. One of the old reasons is poverty. People are looking for a better life, and if they can't have it in this life, they want to lay hold on something that's related to the next. COVID has ravaged some countries. Some of them don't have the tools, the medicines that we have, and that, I think, has caused some people in some other places to be scared stiff. So in some other parts of the world, there are a lot of people who are becoming Christians. We're just not quite in that boat here, at least in many places. He talks about the 7,000 who had not bowed the knee to Baal. We talked a little bit about this Sunday. We may go back and visit some of that with the knee on Sunday in our Acts class, but bowed occurs only 4 times. In the New Testament, it's used in some interesting ways. In Ephesians 3 and verse 14, we find that Paul bowed his knees. You also find Romans 14, 11, not quite there yet. Every knee will one day bow before God. And then in Philippians 2 and verse 10, all, again, should be bowing before the name of Christ. So if people don't want to do it now, they will in eternity. Anybody remember as far as something about Baal? Who were the Ites that worshiped Baal? Anybody recall? the Canaanites. Anybody remember some things about Baal? Baal was considered the son of the grandson of El. He supposedly supposedly controlled the rain, the wind, the clouds. Now you think about that. If you are the God that controls the rain, the wind, and the clouds, what would that affect on earth?
Everything.
Well, that's a good general answer. It would affect everything, but if we try to narrow that down a little bit. All right, you're talking about basically food supply or fertility. And human beings would also be affected in that in some other ways. So if you've got this God, which you associate with the basics that you need in life, but especially fertility, you know, you need the rain, obviously, for your harvest, get it at the right time and get enough of it and make sure that you don't get too much of it or don't get a lot of rain during harvest season. Otherwise, you're going to die. If you believe that there is a God who has that power, then it would be only natural to do what? To worship him, right? And if this God is a fertility God, you know, he allows the land to be fertile, he allows people to be fertile, then your worship would naturally take what form? At least this is how the people reasoned. A fertility God, if you're going to worship him, what would be a logical conclusion for people? Well, no. Think about my question. What would be the means or the method that you would use to worship this God? Well, you could, but that's right. And that's where you get into the orgies that you read about in the Old Testament. They talk about the grove of trees. They weren't up there picking apples and oranges. They set up these groves to engage in all kinds of sexual sin. Now, you can imagine the appeal to that. Here you come over and worship Jehovah, or here you can go over and be involved with the sexual orgy. What do you think some people were going to choose? They were going to choose Baal, the fertility god. And that's why, again and again, in the Old Testament, you see that kind of thing. So this was certainly very offensive to God. When you start looking at some of the ancient pictures of Baal, we've got him pictured as a thunderbolt in the left hand, a club in the other, and sometimes a helmet with horns. So you have a lot of different Baals in the Old Testament. Baal Gad, Baal Haman, Baal Hermon, Baal Peor, a lot of different divisions. Anything you want to add or ask before we skip down to verse 5? Okay, let's look at that passage as well. Paul says, look, there was still a remnant according to the election of grace. Things were bad during the time of Elijah, but God said, I still have some people. And Paul says, even now, with God's grace, there is a remnant. When you find the word remnant, when you read about the word remnant in the Bible, what point is being made? What's a remnant? Anybody know? Person talks about a remnant of cloth. There is
leftover.
Yes, there is some leftover. This is a remnant of the bread that we made and so forth. And that's what Paul is saying. There were always some Hebrews who were in a right relationship with God. So you have to be careful. When you look at Elijah, he seems to have been thinking there is nobody left. And I don't know if he literally believed that, but at least it felt like that. There is nobody trying to follow God. They have all left you, God, but God says, hey, there's a bigger picture here. Do you think we can fall into that same category today? Do you think that there are people who reason in that way today? I'm the only one left. Our church is the only solid church. We're the only sound church in the whole state. You think anybody reasons in that way? Some do. But be careful of that. You do find apostasy. That's obviously here. That certainly took place when you go back and you look at the time of Elijah because of the description. But you want to be very, very careful. Some of the things here when you start looking about in the Bible as far as some examples of remnant. This is something that comes up again and again. Can you think about some Bible stories where we find remnants? A small amount of people were saved. All right, we start with Noah. Most of the people were lost, but God still had a remnant. There were 8 people who were saved. Where else do we find a remnant? Very good. That's another one. Once again, it is very small. We don't know the population of Sodom, Gomorrah, the surrounding areas, but you once again have a handful of people who were saved. Any other examples?
Rahab.
All right, you can look at the house of Rahab. A remnant there as far as her household. What about when the Jews returned from Babylonian captivity? There was a remnant there. Even at the end of time, when you start thinking about the number of people who have lived, and the fact that Jesus said most of them will be lost, not everybody, there will still be a remnant at the end of time. So this is a theme which begins very early in the Bible, and it's going to be true until the end of time. So when you are in a period of time, and obviously our time is limited to maybe 80 or so years in this life, but people who have lived before us, if the earth continues to stand, there will always be a remnant. And sometimes that's very, very small, but that is something that God seems to ensure happens. Brian?
All right, a book my dad had, I think it was Basil Barrett Baxter that had written it, called Christians Only. And one of the things that it did in there was document how that, despite what happened with the church, that there was always somewhere in the world, since Pentecost of the Bible, where God had people that followed through. There's been a remnant, and we think of the restoration movement restoring the church in America. But somewhere in the world, there's always been the light.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have any divinely inspired history, but I'm inclined to think that Baxter was right. Even when you go back and you look at the so-called Dark Ages, where it looked like religious air, it just swept the globe. And from one perspective, it seems like everybody just became encapsulated in that. But I do think that you do find, as you go back and you look at that history, that there are pockets. There are different places in history where people did have access to God's Word. They were teaching it. They were following it. And at the end of time, they will be saved, because it is a biblical principle that there have always been. Sometimes it's been very small. And when you think about, for example, the book of Revelation, Jesus talked about with one congregation, you don't have much power, but that's all right. And there are congregations today that are just like small outposts, almost like the military. You might say a normal base has maybe 2,500 people, but they say, we've got this small station here in this remote area. We only have 25 people stationed there. Well, still, that would be a military installation, and in the church, you see the same kind of thing. So I think Baxter was exactly right. Anybody else before we look at some information from verse 5? All right, I know we've got a lot packed in here. Just a few more things to say, and then we'll take a look at verses 7 through 10. When you look at the end of verse 5, Paul is going back and talking about some of the things that he's already discussed. Back in Romans chapter 9 and verse 15, he made the point that God is the only one who establishes the conditions for grace and salvation. God is at the head of the system, so to speak, and he is the one who says these are the conditions to be saved. And then we could also go back to Romans chapter 3 and verse 24, where Paul talked about, if you want the justification that God gives, it's free. If you want the grace that God gives, that's also available. But that grace and that justification are located somewhere. Where are they found? They're only found in Christ. And if these people were going to experience that and have that, that's where they also needed to be, Jews and both Gentiles. You have, and this is kind of a strange word, I don't know if you noticed this or not, but as you look at, is it in 5 or 6, he doesn't use the word elect, he uses the word election. Is it 5? Okay, let's go back and look at that and see if anybody has something other than election. Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. I think most people expect, the people that God has, they're the elect. But here he talks about the election of grace. And that goes back to Romans chapter 9 and verse 11. God is the one who took the initiative. He set the plan up. He had that foreknowledge that we talked about from Romans chapter 8. And if we choose to be part of that, if we choose to follow his plan, we can have the grace. If not, we are going to be lost. And then in verse 6, when you finally get down there, he's talking about this choice. If you make the choice of salvation by grace, he says, you are saved by grace versus what? Can't be works. It's got to be one or the other. You're either saved by works, which that always fails, or you're saved by grace. And the Jews, they could be saved by grace if they wanted to do what was right and stay away from things like Baal, false religion. The same is true for us. All right, a lot of information there. Anything you want to cover before we look at 7 to 10? Brian?
Do you think in verse 5, the election of grace is God's election, God's graceful election of us, or our election of grace versus law?
I think it's both. Because if we don't choose grace over law, we're lost. So that point is certainly true. And then the other one, I think, is repeated throughout the book. Anybody else? All right, let's jump into 7 through 10. As I said, this chapter's got some challenging stuff into it. In it. What then? Here's another question. That which Israel seeketh for, that he obtained not. But the election obtained it, and the rest were hardened. According as it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear, unto this very day. And David said, let their table be made a snare and a trap, and a stumbling block, and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened, that they may not see, and bow thou down their back always. Well, as you look at that, it doesn't sound all that chummy as far as the Old Testament quotation, and it's related to what we just talked about as far as that previous material. Israel was searching for something. Just like people today, they're looking for something. And Paul says, here's what Israel was looking for. Anybody know? Well, there was that. But let's go back and see if we can expand that answer just a little bit. Let's go back to Romans chapter 9 and verse 31. But Israel, that's what we're talking about here in Romans 11. But Israel, following after a law of righteousness. Israel wanted righteousness. But today there's some people who, as we talk to them, as we see them, as we think about our knowledge of them, they're interested in something. A person says, I really want. You ever seen somebody who says, I really want a job, but they never go out and apply? Or somebody who says, well, you know, I'd really like to go to Hawaii, but they never take any steps to go. You can want something or think that you want something, but you never do anything to achieve the result. And that's kind of what was taking place with the reason. And then Paul, he gives them a reason in Romans 9:32, why the Jews didn't obtain this righteousness that they wanted. He says, verse 32, wherefore, why? He says, because they sought it, how? Not by faith. Well, you might want something, but if you don't do what's required to get what you want, guess what? Don't expect to succeed. You're probably going to fail. And in the spiritual realm, it's always going to work that way. If you want righteousness, if you want to be in a right relationship with God, if you want to be saved, God says there's only one way to accomplish that. And whose way is that? My way. But are there a lot of people who say, oh, I want righteousness. I want Jesus to be my friend. I want to be saved. And this is my spiritual service to God. They do. And that spiritual service is something other. It is by a methodology. It's by a plan other than what God has given. And Paul says that simply cannot work. All right. As you look at Romans chapter 11, verses 5 and 6, remember we talked about before, there are only two possibilities when it comes to salvation. You can be saved by works or you can be saved by grace. Which answer do you think the Jews sought? We want works. And that's why in the life of Christ you see that. The Jews talked about the good works. Do you remember Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount? What did he say? They're the people who stand on the street corner and they get out the big horn to do what? They tell people about their works. Jesus, in talking about the right hand and the left hand, he said, don't let the right hand know what the left is doing. It's not about works. Are we required to do good works? Yes. Does God pay attention to the good works that we do? Yes, but those works cannot save us. When you start looking at the first century, you find three groups of people. I know we typically say two, Jews and Gentiles, but I'm going to give you three tonight. And they were looking for three different things. The Greeks. If you were a Greek in the first century world, what did you want? This was really the number one thing for a Greek.
Knowledge.
You wanted knowledge. And remember, Paul goes to Athens, Acts chapter 17, and they're looking to hear what? Oh, we want to hear some new thing. That's what they wanted. But if you are a Roman, what do you want? You want power. And then if you are a Jew, what do you want? What we just see in Romans chapter 9. They were searching for righteousness. So if you divide them up, not Jew and Gentile, but you divide them up as far as Greeks and Romans and Jews, they're searching for three different things. But they all needed righteousness. And for many of them, they were not willing to pursue the right way. And that was Christ. The election, Paul says, they attained it. They got it because they went about it in the right way. Paul says the Jews, though, at least many of them, they didn't go about it in the right way because they had a heart which was what? The heart was hardened. That's an interesting word, and even if you didn't know this, you could probably kind of guess about it. When you think about something on the hand being hardened, oftentimes what is it?
Callus.
There you go. I don't know. Betty, I guess, got the answer. It is the callus. And as that callus exists and perhaps gets harder and harder, what happens? You know, you can kind of take a pen or maybe even a needle and you can jab it a little bit, and what do you feel? Not much. That scar tissue just builds up and builds up, and pretty soon you say, I can't feel that. Can the heart in the spiritual realm also become spiritually calloused? It can. Can you imagine how Jesus felt? And you do see this in a lot of different ways. He comes along, he performs some miracles, he heals somebody that's been blind from birth, or he heals someone, you know, is kind of all humped over and really can't do anything, and then the people disbelieve. Heals the blind. Heals the people who can't hear. He heals the people who are unable to see. He heals the people who are demon-possessed. He fixes food for thousands of people. And his teachings are unlike anything that people have heard. He meets the religious debaters of his day, the religious experts. Even at a very young age, they can't answer his argumentation. Finally, he's raised from the dead. I mean, all those things. And then they not only disbelieve, but what else is true?
They punish the people that do.
Well, there's that. But they say, your power comes from where? Not from God. But your power source is the devil. That is the ultimate perversity. In Matthew, I was working on this a little earlier. Let's take a look at Matthew chapter 12. Now, maybe Luke 11. There are two places to go. Luke 11 is a little quicker for me. I want to go down to about verse 31. Let's just start at 29. And when the multitude were gathering together unto him, he began to say, this generation is what kind of generation? It's an evil generation. Why? Because it seeks for what? It seeks for a sign. Now, was Jesus saying, you guys want a sign and I'm unwilling to provide a sign? No, he had provided hundreds or thousands of signs. But they simply weren't satisfied with that. And Jesus said, you're going to get a sign, but it's going to be the sign of Jonah the prophet. As Jonah was a sign unto the Ninevites, so the Son of Man is going to be a sign unto this generation. And then here's where I want to focus in on. The Queen of the South shall rise up in judgment. Who do you think the Queen of the South was? The Queen of Sheba. All right. And Jesus says this queen is going to rise up and is going to condemn this generation. Why? For she came from where?
Just a land long away.
All right. I don't like that translation. It's okay, but I think some others might be stronger there. A distant location. I mean, somebody could say that's 50 miles. Anybody have another rendering? All right. Now, that sounds like that's a whole lot further than from a distant land. She came from the ends of the earth. We don't know exactly where she was from. Some people think modern-day Yemen. But the estimates are that this lady, this queen, traveled 1,000 miles thereabouts one way. Now, can you imagine that? In that ancient day and time, roughly 1,000 miles one way. If you're traveling 1,000 miles, you think some of that country is probably going to be tough to navigate? You think you might be exposed to some dangers? Now, if you're going to travel under those conditions, way back when, 1,000 miles as a ruler, how important do you think that's going to be? I mean, you think she could have sent some people and said, bring me back some stuff and go get a good report? If you're going to travel 1,000 miles as the queen, we don't know how old she was, but whether she was young or old, that really doesn't change the point very much. And she went that far to do what? To hear the wisdom of Solomon. Now, here's the point. Jesus says this lady travels this great distance, and she wanted to hear a mere man. Jesus says, who's shown up for you? I have. And who am I? A mere man? I am deity. I am God in the flesh. You're never going to see anyone. You're never going to hear anyone. You're going to see miracles from anyone more important than me. And then what else? Did Jesus say, if you want to see me, the Son of God, you've got to travel 1,000 miles. Leave home. Risk your life. Maybe lose your job. What's Jesus do? He comes to this small place called Palestine, and what's he do? I'm going to come to your... It's like a concert. What happens when you got a band? What do? They say, all right, we're going to put our roots down in New York City, and if you want to hear us, you've got to come to New York City. Got to come to Nashville, Tennessee. Most groups do what? They travel. You know, we're going to be here, and we're going to be here. We're going to come to a location near you. That's generally how the marketing strategy is working. And what's Jesus do? He begins to visit these cities. Now, if you have Jesus, and he specifically says he was greater than Solomon, he's going specifically to these cities and saying, here I am, I'm putting myself out there as far as teaching and miracles. If the people, like the Ninevites, they believe Jonah, and you've got this Queen of Sheba, she believed in Solomon and is willing to do all this stuff, then for me to come, based on who I am, and I'm at your doorstep, and you are not just willing to reject me, but some of you folks are saying that I am in league with the devil, then guess what? Jesus said when judgment day comes, who's going to stand against you? Who's going to be used as evidence against you? All right, the Ninevites, and then as we specifically emphasize, the Queen of Sheba. So this all relates to what you have here in Romans chapter 11. Paul and Jesus both pounded that point as far as the hardness of the heart. I mean, these people were callous when they said these things about Christ. And you also have the idea of the people being blind. That's exactly what it was. So he talks about, back in Romans chapter 9 and verse 21, he says, you are vessels of dishonor. Back in Romans chapter 9 and verse 7, you are like Pharaoh. Pharaoh saw all those signs. He would not believe in spite of all the great things that were done. The magicians at some points, at some times, could not repeat the miracles that were being done by Moses and Aaron. When you have people who live in this way, there are a lot of passages that can be related. We gave you some from Luke chapter 11, but let's look at two more. And then we'll pause for some comments and then look at verse 8. Acts chapter 13 and verse 46. We also want to take a look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 10 to 12. Who wants to be our Acts 13, verse 46 reader? Acts 13, verse 46, that'll be Brian. Then over in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, let's look at verses 10 through 12. Who wants that one? 2 Thessalonians 2, 10, 11, and 12. Dolores. Let's start with Acts chapter 13 and verse 46. Brian?
Did Paul and Barnabas wax bold and said, it was necessary that the word of God should first have been spoken to you, but seeing you put it from you and judge yourselves unworthy of everlasting life, will we turn to the Gentiles?
The main part of that thought that I want is at the end of the verse. Paul says, you have judged yourselves, what? Unworthy. Do you remember the illustration I gave you about Thanksgiving and Christmas? Here's the person who has a nice meal prepared. They practically beg you on multiple occasions. They say, come at a time that's convenient for you. You don't have to bring anything. We really want you to come. And what happens with the invitation? They spurn it. They mock you. They do everything that they can to grind that invitation into the dust. And when somebody does that, we say, okay, you have made your choice. We have pleaded with you. And if that's the way that you want to act and behave, good luck at Wendy's. That's Acts 13:46. Now let's take a look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 10 to 12.
In all the ways that wickedness deceives those who are perishing, they perish because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so that they will believe the lie and so that all will be condemned who have not believed the truth but have delighted in wickedness.
I was on a campaign several years ago, foreign country, and there was a young preacher, he said, boy, that verse really bothers me. I find it very difficult that the God of the Bible, who is described as loving all people, would send them a powerful delusion. That seems pretty mean. You still there, Dolores?
Yeah.
Let's go back and read verses 10 and 11 one more time.
Does it really start in 9?
Well, okay, you can start back there in 9 if you like.
I'm just saying it makes more sense.
Okay.
The coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with how Satan works. He will use all sorts of displays of power through signs and wonders that serve the lie, and all the ways that wickedness deceives those who are perishing. They perish because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. For this reason, God sends them a powerful delusion so that they will believe the lie.
All right, God sends them a powerful delusion, but back up a verse. What's he say? They did not receive the love of the truth. Going back to our Thanksgiving meal again, God says, here it is. I have made all things ready. Jesus even gave a parable about that. The king, he makes all things ready, goes out, check out the highways, check out the byways, go out there into the hedges, beg and plead, urge people to come in. I've got plenty of room. I want everybody to hear. And the people say, I would not. Do you remember that teaching where Jesus talked about the people who gave excuses? Remember what some of the excuses were? Oh, I got married. I bought some animals. I got to go and test them. I've got some land I've got to check out. Worthless. Junk. Excuses. No basis in fact whatsoever. Well, I mean, sure, the people did that, but as far as I got to go now, no. And when people act like that, they want to believe a lie. Now, you can go back to verse 9. God does do that. He does do that to the devil, verse 9. But God says, if you want to believe the lie, I will let you. You have free will. You have free choice. But know what you're thrusting from yourself. Anything that you want to add or ask based on all the things that we talked about thus far?
I sometimes think Satan